Have you ever been in a situation where in your gut, that deep seat of emotion, what the ancients called the, what we call the heart, where you knew there that what was taking place around you just wasn't right, but you didn't know quite how to deal with it? Earlier this week, in reading for these lessons, I was reminded of a scene from the book, The Adventures of Huck Finn. Huck has faked his own death, and in fleeing down river, he finds Jim, a slave who had lived in the same household as Huck. And Jim has run away since he has found out that he might soon be sold and separated from his wife and children forever. Together they care for one another as they survive near brushes with death. But after some time, Huck feels the weight of his law-breaking and the burdens of the social norms of his time. He realizes that he has aided and abetted a slave's escape, and that this is dangerous. Huck also begins to think of the financial hardship that might come with this unlawful act, so he drafts a letter to the woman who took him in, attempting to let them know of Jim's whereabouts. Now, at first, Huck feels almost a sense of relief after having written the letter. He has done what an upright citizen is expected to do, right? But then, as he recounts the ways that Jim has saved his life, when they had braved thunderstorms together and evaded swindlers, Huck begins to realize that this churning in his gut wasn't so much about the act of breaking the law. It was more an internal struggle about having to uphold a law that would punish a man for wanting to love his family. And as Huck comes to this realization of the unjust system that he is being forced to participate in, he takes the letter up and rips it apart. This morning we heard from a very different sort of letter, though some of the parallels are remarkable. Completely out of the ordinary for any of the letters that we have from Paul or in Paul's name, the letter of Philemon is unusual for its brevity. We heard all but two verses of it, for its content and for its intimacy. From what we can gather in this letter, Paul is in prison, possibly in Rome, at the end of his life. And here he is writing to Philemon, a Christian likely from Colossae. A slave from Philemon's house has escaped, fled for some reason. We aren't told the whole story. And this slave, Onesimus, has been useful to Paul in prison. But Paul feels uneasy, apparently, about having Onesimus remain with him. And so the decision is made by Paul, by the others from Colossae with him, by Onesimus himself, we do not know. But the decision is made to send Onesimus back to his former master, Philemon, with this letter that we just heard as his cover. Now, we don't know the outcome, but that this letter exists at all today says to me that something was changed by its being written. And part of what makes this letter so compelling to me is that coursing under the surface of it are currents of conflict. right? One conflict is around identity. Can Onesimus be considered anything more than property? What relationship is primary as a follower of Christ? And more subtly for Paul in this letter, there seems to be an internal conflict about approach, about process. For the law was clearly on Philemon's side, and so how will Paul engage him? Unexpectedly, Paul draws upon a radical understanding of family to make his appeal. And in a way, and I realize this is going to sound a little bit crazy, but in a way, he looks to Jesus' understanding of family to do this. Now, how many people remember the gospel that we just read a few minutes ago? All right, that's, I was expecting a little bit better, but we'll go with that. So I realize this sounds a bit ridiculous because in our gospel, Jesus uses some strong words to challenge his disciples, right? It sounds nothing like those Christian family values we hear so much about. It's almost as if Jesus is looking for ways to offend. Hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, even life itself. You know, when we hear a passage like this, it is no wonder that Jesus got himself into deep trouble. Remember that family was the building block of the ancient kinship system. It was identity and it was obligation. Your family gave you your primary identity. You and everyone else knew who you were because of your relations, for better and for worse. It was also your safety net, your basic financial unit, your essential social network. You could not survive without your family unless you had tremendous wealth. And so for Jesus to teach against this foundational system was shocking, almost unimaginable. And so why? Even if this is hyperbolic speech common at this time, why demand such actions from your followers? Well, from the almost parables that follow, it is clear that Jesus is using this language to show his disciples what will take place if they are going to follow him. For in order to be his followers, a deep reordering of their lives will need to take place. They are going to be reforming their lives from the ground up. So some of this hyperbole is to show that one must count the cost. In addition, this passage shows that one of these reorderings will be around kinship. For one of the truly radical aspects of the earliest followers of Jesus was their reimagination of who kin could be. It was no longer simply defined by blood. Right? This is evidenced in Jesus' action in John's gospel from the cross. You remember, Mother Mary and the beloved disciple are at the foot of the cross. Jesus says, "Woman, here is your son," and to the beloved disciple, "Here is your mother." The earliest followers of Christ reformed family so that it included mother and father, grandmother and grandchild, and those unrelated fellow followers who found communion with God. Rather than a negation of familial bonds, it was an extension of the depth of that love. And so it's from this sense that Paul approaches this letter to Philemon. When confronted with this conflictual relationship, right? How to send this slave back to one considered his master, Paul turns to a radical understanding of family to meet this, right? Notice the familial language that's all throughout this letter. Paul reminds Philemon of the brotherly relationship that they share already in verse 7 And then again in verse 20. In verse 10, Paul tells of the parental love that he has felt for Onesimus during this time in prison. And finally, Paul seeks to extend this relationship of familial love from Philemon to Onesimus in verse 16, that Onesimus may return, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. In this reimagining of relationships, structures of culture that previously served to subjugate are fundamentally reordered. Kinship is found despite great cultural difference. But what is critical to this reordering is the way in which it's done. Friends, listen. In verse 8, Paul writes, listen. For this reason, though I am bold enough in Christ to command you to do your duty, yet I would rather appeal to you on the basis of love. Though Paul has all the authority to command, he chooses instead to persuade. One scholar has called this the principle of non-dominance. The principle of non-dominance. And it is a hallmark of the ways in which we are called to live as followers of Christ. Though we may be able to command rightful action, it is only when we are able to engage and persuade that a victory like Martin King's double victory is made possible. And so it's with these twin pillars, a radical understanding of family and this principle of non-dominance, that I have been wondering about what this kind of discipleship means for us today. And I have to say, friends, that in hearing this passage all week, this gospel passage about the king who goes to wage war but first sits down to consider the cost, I have found it hard not to lay down alongside the most recent horror in this civil war in Syria. The news this past week of the use of chemical weapons to kill hundreds of civilians would be unimaginable were it not for the images that have come forward. And so it's incumbent upon us to respond as a member of the global community. And as this week has unfolded, I must say that I do not have the answer. But I am increasingly becoming frustrated with the questions. Whether it is Representative Pelosi's calling strikes of scores of missiles a non-war, or Senator Feinstein's insistence that the only way for the United States to maintain its morality, reputation, and credibility is through limited but forceful military action, I am not convinced that we have truly counted the cost, nor have we fully asked the questions. What is the end we seek? What is the most just and compassionate way to come to that end? To be clear, I do not support inaction. To not act is to allow for this latest heinous atrocity to stand as permissible. But I do not believe that the only remaining response is an escalation of violence launched from afar. And neither do many Syrian Christians who are struggling to make their voices heard. For Christian voices in Syria and Christian voices around the world, from the Archbishop of Canterbury to Pope Francis to the leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention, there has been a cry for another way, that third way of Christ. Where if indeed our sisters and brothers are those suffering, in this case, from this hellacious war, then we have a responsibility, an obligation to appeal for them. And if we follow the path of Paul and the path of Christ, dominance by force and by threat will not ultimately allow us to prevail. in a turn of irony, as he proposed missile strikes as the only response to the crossing of this red line, just a week ago, President Obama led this nation in celebrating the words of one of the most prominent practitioners of nonviolent action in the face of brutality and bloodshed. These are the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King from his 1967 book, which feels as contemporary today as I'm sure it did then, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? Dr. King wrote, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. So it goes. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." May this be so, sisters and brothers. May this be so.